Hi, I'm Tim Brody, and you're listening to Moving Forward, a podcast about relationships, community, and connections. Dr. Cal is a forensic psychologist. He's an expert in violence and risk prediction, and has developed a theory about anxiety that looks at the evolutionary process of the brain. He's so much more than that, though. He's also an author of a number of books, including the Blake Wader series, set here in Halifax. Dr. Callan was a guest speaker at our last Mo Monday's Halifax online event, and we had the opportunity to catch up with him and hear more of his thoughts. Dr. Brad Callan, it's really fantastic to have you on this podcast today. One of the things that you talked about during your Mo Monday's experience was the notion that you've been battling anxiety for quite a long while. What specific tools have you found that helped you?
Well, I guess until I had this new theory of understanding where anxiety originates from, I had primarily used a lot of distraction, staying busy and just distraction. And as an example, like, I think nighttime is a particularly difficult time for a lot of people that have chronic anxiety. You know, as they're lying in bed trying to get to sleep, that oftentimes their brains are leading them around on these journeys to the most anxiety-provoking topics. You know, things that have gone wrong in the recent past, or upcoming activities or tasks that are creating anxiety in that person as well. So, in those kind of situations, for myself, I used to just try and do lists in my head, or run little storylines from shows I've seen, or invent little stories myself. It all kind of worked for me, in particular, because I have oftentimes attempted to be an author in my second career, in addition to being a psychologist. So, in part, this creative exercise of distracting myself, I always thought was potentially useful in a longer term in terms of mapping out storylines. But with my new understanding of the evolution of anxiety as being such an adaptive tool, now I realize that those down times, those times when our attention is allowed to drift, it's an evolutionary mechanism to cause you to drift towards anxiety-provoking topics. And that distraction actually is a fairly legitimate means to take your head off of those kind of topics.
Has our evolutionary process then stopped? Are we done?
I got asked that almost that exact question when I did a big talk at the Halifax Central Library about a month ago. Where are we still evolving? Because a lot of people wonder that. That's one of the common sort of arguments against evolution, is if we evolved to this point, then where's the, you know, ongoing evolution? So people have to realize that evolution is this dynamic process where the environment, as well as your impact on it, have to work in concert. And when one sort of becomes dominant, which is our influence as people over the other, being the environment, then you artificially change what evolution looks like. So what I mean by that is, we, I believe, have not only halted evolution to some degree, we probably have become on a pathway towards devolving to some extent. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, there are genetic differences, weaknesses, traits that come along that, you know, 200,000 years ago would have been a detriment to your ongoing survival. For example, nearsightedness, which I can say with impunity because I am very nearsighted. Mm. I wore glasses since I was in grade 3. And that's a trait or characteristics or genetic abnormality that would not have been adaptive for your survival 200,000 years ago. And those people with the nearsightedness would have, you know, struggled to hunt or to contribute to their tribes in any way, or to, you know, pick out predators in the environment. So they would have been vulnerable. So then less likely that characteristic would have been carried on to future generations. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, and this is where the environment versus our influence over it, you know, that balance tips. Nowadays, we compensate for most of those kind of weaknesses. So we wear glasses. And so that means that you have every much chance to survive and thrive and carry on traits as anyone else, even with your nearsightedness. So then that becomes a trait that gets carried on. And you can think probably of a lot of different other traits and characteristics, like chronic health problems and, you know, nut allergies and food allergies. Those kind of things that without the kind of intervention from society that we see, would not have been adaptive for your ongoing survival.
I get it. So our scientific mind is now overcoming the evolutionary process because we're manually fixing things rather than nature fixing them.
That's right. And so that's answer one to your question. The second part of the answer, I think, is a little more optimistic in some ways. And that is, as we grow and evolve as in our understanding of who we are as people and where we came from, I think that then allows us the opportunity to take positive steps in changing it. I mean, there's been so much research in the last, 10, 15 years about mindfulness and just the exercise of being mindfully aware of your environment, done even over the course of 5 minutes a day for a few weeks, actually makes structural changes in your brain. Mm-hmm. That you can change how you perceive and understand the world, and you can lower anxiety, you can increase concentration. So with deliberate, sustained effort, I think we can make changes. Now, whether you call that evolutionary changes, I'm not sure, but even my own work here around anxiety and evolution, I think, provides us an opportunity to have an impact on these changes that had developed over the course of millions of years and solidified 200,000 years ago. But it gives us sort of a way in to have some changes in a positive way happen.
I'm really curious about that, and I want to talk about that mindfulness aspect. From your perspective, what actually is mindfulness, and how does one use that in their daily life to help improve their own situation?
I'm going to give you a couple of different sort of practical advice pieces here that relate to that. First of all, and one of the easiest, and particularly relevant in these days of the pandemic, is that we have to realize that our brain is a processing center that is designed in a certain way, and it's designed to really hone in on problematic, negative, scary, survival-related material. So the news people know that. So that's why the news is all bad news and scary stuff, because really the term news does not mean bad news. And yet you'd be hard-pressed to watch newscasts without 90% or higher being about horror stories and negative things going on. So our brains are geared to look for negative stuff. But that doesn't mean you have to feed it negative stuff all the time. And the example I use when I talk about this is if you had a friend who suffered from a weight problem, and that friend complained all the time about my knees hurt, and I don't have any energy, and my back is sore, and obviously complaining about weight-related issues. And then you watch that friend eat at McDonald's day after day, or eat bags of potato chips, or drink full sugar pops. You think, you know what, do you really understand your problem? And if you really have that much concern about your weight, why do you eat the way you eat? In the same way, if you have friends who say, I'm anxious, I'm worried all the time, I can't get to sleep, and you see they're constantly checking their Twitter, they're constantly checking their Facebook, they're watching Fox News every night, they have a little set on their phone, they have even the Apple Watch, so they get, by-the-minute updates on world events. You are feeding your brain junk food in the same way as a person who struggles with a weight problem feeds themselves improperly and complains about it. So one of the first steps I took when I first started looking at this area, probably about 8 months ago, is I stopped listening to the news, I stopped watching newscasts, for the most part. I mean, I'm not completely ignorant about what goes on in the world, because it's almost impossible in this information age to do that. But I used to, as an example, when I went to work in the mornings, I would throw CBC News on my radio, and I often would listen to it on the way to work and on the way back. And it was always stories, and I didn't realize this, but it was always stories that were irritating to me, left me with this, either frustration, annoyance, or anxiety about the state of the world, all of things that I had no control over. So then I would have this lingering negative emotion that would stick with me for the rest of that day, and then I would reinforce it on the way home. And what I noticed, too, in limiting and reducing my information, including turning off all notifications on my phone so that I don't get up-to-the-minute updates on everything all the time, I noticed that my issues with going to sleep at night changed dramatically, that I didn't have all these things bouncing around my head about the troubles in the world, so I could actually sleep better. Even my dreams changed when I started limiting the amount of garbage information I was putting into my head. And that's one of the first and easiest things that we can start to do, Because, and this is kind of how it relates back to mindfulness, because it doesn't mean your brain is empty. Mindfulness is about paying attention to the quality of the situation you're in right now in this moment. So the colors and the sensations and the smells and when you're eating, the tastes and so on. That's information that you can fill your head with. It's more relevant to your present situation and doesn't leave you with those lingering worries and concerns.
That's absolutely incredible. So mindfulness allows you to increase that ability to, in this moment, say, is this something that's causing me pleasure, or is it something that's moving me from pleasure? And where do I want to be?
Mindfulness can also help provide you with the perspective that many of us lack. And where I'm going with that is there's a phenomenon from mindfulness referred to as discrepancy monitoring. And this is something huge. And this is something that I believe has roots in evolution too, because discrepancy monitoring at its core is noticing when something has gone wrong or has gone not the way that you expect it should go, mm-hmm. judging that event as bad or wrong, and then imagining a idealistic way or version of how that could have played out. So a real world example would be if you were stopped at in a left turn lane waiting for the light to turn and there's a person in front of you. The left turn advance arrow comes on, the person in front of you does not go immediately. And you kind of wait, you know, socially what you think is an appropriate amount of time before you lay on the horn at this person. And then finally that person clues in and goes. And then maybe you miss that light because there was just so much time passed. It was a short advance arrow anyway. Mm-hmm. So discrepancy monitoring is this person didn't pay attention. They didn't go when the light turned. That is wrong and or bad. So that's the evaluative component. And the idealistic way it should have gone that you imagine in your head is that person, if they're going to be on the road, if they're going to be driving, they should pay attention to what's going on because they're influencing everybody else. They've now made me miss this light. This creates in the person this negative vat of emotion that they feel they've been wrong. They feel like this person is getting away with something or should have their license revoked. So there's all this negative stuff that goes along with it. So what mindfulness can help us understand is you can undo this discrepancy monitoring by understanding the judgment that that event is bad or wrong is skewed. And when I was with the library a month ago, we did a little exercise where we started ranking some things on the scale of 0 being not bad at all to 10 being the worst thing ever. Some of the things that would go up to 10 on the scale would be like if a family member gets diagnosed with a terminal illness, or that there's a horrible car accident and you're injured, or you're fired from work or something. Like it's not that hard to think of terrible 10 level events, but once you anchor your scale with 10 in that way, having to wait an extra 20-30 seconds at a light before you turn and you drive safely home becomes a 0. Mm-hmm. It is no longer a negative event, which then negates the need to imagine an idealized world where this guy was paying attention, because it doesn't matter anymore. And that's kind of where we want to get to in our world, is that this discrepancy monitoring, once you understand discrepancy monitoring, you'll see it happens everywhere, all the time, that we're constantly judging the actions that we see around us, thinking, that's not how it should have gone, that shouldn't be that way. Whether we're listening to the news and thinking about politicians and they shouldn't get away with this, or whether it's coworkers or whether it's people at the superstore that we're watching, it just leaves us with this reservoir of frustration and anger and irritation. Once we start to be more mindful that those judgments are lacking in any kind of real-world perspective of what actually represents something that's bad or wrong, that starts to wash away, and we start to not have this constant irritation in our lives.
I think you're dead on, especially today, where we're supposed to be socially distancing, and now everyone is looking for examples of other folks that aren't doing that. It creates such a level of anxiety, and that's totally of no value.
Exactly. Yeah. And oftentimes it's based on not even understanding what we're observing. So you're right with that example. Like you might see two people that are not obeying the 6 feet rule, but you don't know what their relationship is necessarily. And yet this discrepancy monitoring phenomenon is just so automatic and reflexive in most people that you get to the point of the irritation before you even realize and take a step back and you know, think twice about whether it even deserves to be evaluated. Which to me is the perfect marriage of Eckhart Tolle and mindfulness. Is that
yes.
It's about staying in the now and being fully present in that, and allowing others to have that same experience without, you know, putting judgment on them for doing it.
You're absolutely right. Let's talk about this transition then into author. You alluded to that just a while ago in our conversation, and you've done some really, really cool things. You've written a number of books. The one that really struck me as I must read this was your book In Tongues of the Dead. For anyone that hasn't looked it up, you need to. This looks like a very cool book. And it talks about the Voynich manuscript.
The Voynich manuscript is it's considered the holy grail of cryptology. I think it's about a 400-page handwritten book that was done anywhere from a couple hundred to 500 years or longer ago, because they've had trouble dating it. And it's written in this continuous script in a language that no one has ever been able to identify. It's accompanied in the book with all sorts of strange drawings. People have been poring over this manuscript for years, trying to figure out what is this book all about. It actually exists. It's a real book. It's at Yale University in their rare books collection. It's been such a mysterious book without any answers to it that Yale University published every single page of it online. There's high definition PDF pictures of every page, so if anyone wants to, they can try and decode it themselves. I came across this story about the Voynich manuscript probably in about 2006 or 2007, just, you know, a year or two before the book came out. I was really looking for a new book project to get involved in writing, and I was so taken by this story that, you know, this manuscript exists, and even with computers, people couldn't decode it. But computers did show people that the format of the language did seem to follow the general rules of a language, where, you know, some letters repeat more often than others, word sizes varied around a certain core length, and things that you would find in a real language, but they just could not decode it. My premise for the book, where the fiction part comes in, is that the book had religious origins, and it was written in a phenomenon in churches that is kind of referred to as tongues. So speaking in tongues is a term many people have heard in relation to religion, where someone is so overcome by the Holy Spirit, is how it's often referred to, that they begin to speak in a language that no one can recognize. And this is oftentimes during a church service. And someone sort of stands up, they're overcome by their spirituality, and they begin to sort of talk in this strange language. So I thought, why couldn't it kind of work the other way, that rather than speaking that language, that you can be sort of overcome and read languages that you've never seen before. And so the book, In Tongues of the Dead, begins with a priest who's been sort of undercover as a librarian at Yale University, is on rounds and comes to the Voynich manuscript display and finds this young child standing there staring into the case, and asks the child what he sees, and the child basically admits that he can read it, that he has that ability. But then he sort of goes off with his class, and now this priest is on the hunt of trying to stay in touch, because this is what he's been waiting for. This is what the Vatican had stationed him there to do, is to find someone who would eventually be able to read this book. And then it's a sort of an adventure from there, with lots of different characters getting involved and trying to protect this kid. And some of the characters are trying to get rid of this child. And it spans right across the U.S. and ends up in Halifax for its grand finale, because I always like to set things back home.
The story has to do with soulless beings created by the crossbreeding of angels and humans and despised by God. You've picked up on a storyline that's not necessarily mainstream.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I like to do when I'm writing is to include little-known facts. I enjoy that when I'm reading myself, to come across something I've never heard of, and then maybe to Google and find out, you know, this is true, this isn't something the author made up, it actually exists. And so one of those details in Tongues of the Dead is a race of beings known as the Nephilim, which you can find in the Old Testament. It talks about angels that came down and had relationships with humans, and they had these monstrosity children who were these giants who roamed the earth for some time. And in fact, the biblical lore of it is that God was so displeased with all of these sort of mutant angels roaming the earth and who had such great physical power over the humans, that was the reason for the flood. So the Noah's Ark story and the flood, It's a very little known aspect that you can find, and this is in every Bible that you'll find today. It was because of this race of giants that God actually flooded the world to get rid of them. So the Nephilim, one of the things I play with in my book there, was that maybe some aspects of that race didn't disappear. They just sort of went into hiding, and that they have an agenda of their own, and it competes with the Vatican and what they're trying to do with this book, and that the book actually centers into it too, but you'll have to read it to figure it all out.
I will. That's a promise. Tell me then, how does a man who, very evidence-based, a strong mind towards the evolutionary process, yet you've also found this hidden nugget in the Old Testament of the Bible. How do you balance that notion about strong evidence-based scientific mind with the spiritual element in your own life? Is that you?
Well, it was me. I actually was raised Christian and went to Sunday school and the whole bit, and then actually even taught Sunday school for many years, right into my early days of university, was involved in the church. Mm-hmm. And then through my own thinking and my own reflections on stuff, my views have changed since then, but I understand how important and how significant religion and spirituality are to people. So at the time of the writing of In Tongues of the Dead, it was, for me, it was sort of just a natural marriage of psychology and science and some of the mysticism of spiritual beliefs. I thought it was interesting to play with.
You've got two books out now that look like they're going to be long-lived and carry on. Tell me more, and you've got the Russian, and the common theme in both of those is the main character, Dr. Blake Wader.
That's right. So it's interesting that when I first started writing many, many years ago, I was more of a concept writer, that I looked for good ideas, good storylines, and to some extent, I felt compelled to make those storylines fit within the darker world of forensic psychology because I'm a forensic psychologist. So my first book, Lost Sanity, and then the second book, a sequel to it, Method of Madness, were very dark forensic psychology, thriller, mystery type books. Mm-hmm. They were all based on sort of high-end concepts. And then In Tongues of the Dead came out a number of years later, and it was also sort of, I guess, a high-end concept type book with this Voynich manuscript and some biblical references. And then I had another little break. My second break there after In Tongues of the Dead back in 2008 was really because I was very involved in family life and I didn't have a lot of spare time. So when I finally did get some spare time, which was about 4 years ago, I wanted to start a new series of books. And I realized that the high concept books were not really what I was drawn to anymore, and that I sort of took some time to sit back and think about what do I like. Like if I read a book, sometimes I think, boy, I wish I'd written that. So what's sort of the common theme of those books? And I realized I just really enjoy the character stuff. So I wanted to switch gears and make it less about a high-end concept and more about a character-based story that had humor. You know, there was action, there were some scientific facts or interesting details that people could Google themselves and find out about. But really, to me, it was about establishing some characters that you would start to care about. And Blake Wader is the psychologist in these books, and he's sort of a quirky psychologist, works in private practice, has a contract with the military, but he's, you know, he's confident at times, he's sarcastic at times, sometimes uses humor in moments that probably don't require it, and it gets him in trouble. And then that's paired with Charles Pellegrino, which is this one of his patients who ends up kind of getting involved in some of the, you know, different things that go on in Blake's life. And he's this big, mysterious, dangerous soldier guy that had an accident years ago and has some lingering brain damage as a result that makes him a little bit edgy and sort of prone to angry outbursts. And he's a nice match for Blake Wader in terms of them approaching situations. Then there's this mysterious assassin, British assassin female character that gets involved too and begins to play increasingly larger roles in both the lives of Blake and Charles. But to me, the story and all the events that happen are sort of the backdrop now for how these characters develop and the relationships together and the dialogue that kind of drives things along. And that's really what I've enjoyed. So when you talk about this having some longevity to it, I'm hopeful it will.
I'm hoping that this gets picked up and it gets turned into a movie line that we can all claim as truly the Maple Leaf. I'm loving it.
I would too.
Who is Blake Wader? Is he you?
So that's also a really interesting question, because he was me when I first started writing this particular story, Tell Me More. I just wrote me. In fact, I didn't even disguise it. The character's name in my first draft of this book was Brad, and he acted like me. He had sort of the humor and sarcasm that I frequently have. I made him really very close to who I am. My process for writing was that I would oftentimes get some people that I'm very close to, that I trust, to read early editions of the book and give me some feedback. And for the first few drafts of Tell Me More, when it was still written as Brad Kellen, before I handed the book out to people, I just did a search and replace and changed his name so that it wasn't Brad anymore. Mm-hmm. And then I handed these books out to my test readers. And the feedback that came back was that Chuck or Charles, the big military guy, people loved him. They thought he was great. But that Blake Wader character, they thought, we don't like him. He's kind of nasty. He's a little bit too sarcastic. You know, he's not. He doesn't have enough empathy for people at times. So they gave me some strong feedback. So I actually did go back and rewrite. And so the Blake Wader you see now, he has obviously has some traits. And when you read the book, if you know me, you'll see some of that. I get that feedback from people a lot, that they'll read a line and they'll say, I can totally see you saying that. But he is not me 100% anymore. There's definitely lots and lots of elements that are fictionalized.
I am very much looking forward to reading these two books.
This work I've done around evolution and understanding our minds, I really believe in that too. So I think there might even be a nonfiction book in my history in the next 10 years, in the next 10 years or so.
I want to thank you so very much for being with me this afternoon and participating in this. It's really been a great experience for me.
I very much enjoyed it, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. We'll talk again soon.
You bet.
You've been listening to Tim Brody and the show Moving Forward, an offering in relationships, community, and connections. We are proud to support the Society of Atlantic Heroes, the group caring about first responders, veterans, and military members in Canada's Atlantic region. It's about our community, and our community is about us. Thanks for listening.